You're listening to Harris Smith Radio, Episode 2. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode of Harris Smith Radio is about hydroponics, subtropical fruit in Canada, and the stars in the winter sky. We begin on the opposite coast from last episode. Back then, we visited a salt maker in Bonavista, Newfoundland. This time, we travel to Salt Spring Island off the coast of British Columbia. There, we find Jane Squire, who's nurturing a citrus grove under glass. Next, we look up, way up, and ask Harris Smith resident astronomer Rob Dick why it is that the night sky in winter looks so clear. The stars above and the lemons and limes below. It's all here in the next half hour of Harris Smith Radio. Settle in. Jane Squire has learned that when life hands you a greenhouse, you make lemons and limes and lettuce and basil and, well, all manner of hydroponic produce. Jane started hydroponic gardening in Calgary back when hydroponics was just a wacky idea and an article in Harris Smith magazine. She used that article as an inspiration to build a thriving greens business based on the nutrient film technique, NFT for short. These days, Jane has a 6,000 square foot greenhouse on Salt Spring Island. She's just wrapped up her career as a purveyor of butter, lettuce, and basil, and is using her ingenuity, some backyard swimming pools, a solar-powered anaerobic digester, and an Inspector Gadget coat full of gizmos to grow 30 varieties of citrus, avocados, guava, pineapples, and more. It's like she's created Canada's largest subtropical terrarium. How? To find that out, I talk with her, not far from her greenhouse of earthly delights. Jane, thanks for joining me. One of the things that really strikes me looking over the article you wrote in Harris Smith magazine and reading some of the background online is that you're really somebody who, in terms of growing, is always trying to push the limits of what's possible. You're growing hydroponic lettuce in really sub-ideal conditions. So why don't we start there and talk about your adventures with pushing the limits of what you can grow and where?
Well, we started out in Alberta growing hydroponics, learned about that system of growing because we were wanting to be farmers west of Calgary, which is, I think it's zone 3A. There's really only 1 month in the year where there isn't frost. So we were trying to figure out how could we actually make a living at growing things, and hydroponics seemed to be a really positive idea regarding actually making a living. So we started to experiment with that, and that was in the early days of hydroponics in Canada. So the government was quite helpful in research and support, and we were able to start a small greenhouse and expand threefold within 2 years because it was just such a good business, actually.
Right, and I think I read somewhere you mentioned that you got the idea from hydroponics from Harris Smith magazine, right?
We did. We were in a fairly isolated area in Papua New Guinea working there, and a friend of ours sent us some Harris Smith magazines, which were just like gold for us, and we just studied those, and then we saw this article Harris Smith had done on Helmut Julineau, who is really a pioneer in small-scale hydroponics in Ontario, and we took the article apart with a magnifying glass looking at, you know, the photos, and really got into hydroponics through that article.
That's great that it happened that way. Why hydroponics? You said that it was a good way to generate revenue to grow stuff. So what in particular appealed to you about it?
Well, it's highly automated system that recirculates water. We were located in an area that had really poor quality water, very high in salt, and we just were looking at what kind of productivity we could get out of a controlled environment greenhouse. And lettuce was, at that time, well, still is, pretty much shipped from California. So in Calgary, the lettuce that was arriving there was pretty tough coming up over the mountains and finally making it to the store. It was in pretty rough shape. And we could produce a really high-quality tender butter lettuce with that fabulous sunlight that they have in Alberta in the wintertime. So actually, the productivity was really high. We didn't have to supplement lights or anything like that. And also the price of gas was really reasonable. So we were able, out of I think it was about 14,000 square feet, produce a continuous supply of lettuce for the Calgary Co-op grocery stores. That was what our goal was, to meet their demand.
That's great. Now, from there, you moved to where you are now, Salt Spring Island, and you set up a greenhouse operation there as well, right? And I want to sort of combine two things. So you talked about being in Papua New Guinea, so you got exposure to tropical fruits that down there. You're growing lettuce in Calgary, and now you're out in Salt Spring Island, and you sort of married the two, right?
Yeah, eventually. I mean, we moved here in 93, and then it wasn't until 2014 that I actually started doing the subtropicals. I was mostly trying to make a living. I took the business over by myself in 2001, and then it became from a really part-time job when I shared it with my ex-partner to a very full-time job. So I had to do a lot of innovations to make it workable. And then as time went on and, you know, debts were paid off and all that kind of stuff, then I started to get excited about, I always was excited in energy efficiencies and, of course, was collecting all of the water for the full hydroponic production from the roof of the greenhouse, because in this location I didn't have access to any other water. So always looking at more efficient systems and trying to get off of non-renewables. So I was experimenting in the background of the production time the whole time, coming right up with ideas. It wasn't until 2014 that I thought, okay, now I can start to really change things.
So let's talk a bit about the location. Describe to me what your farm looks like on Salt Spring Island. Where on the island it is? How big is it?
I'm in the middle of the island, pretty much, pretty close to Ganges, and I have 3 acres. And half of that is in Douglas fir forest, beautiful, very tall, majestic forest that's on the north side of the property. So the exposed area is over an acre and a half, and the greenhouse is on that area, and the house and the workshop. And then I have the green space is planted to many types of fruit trees and nut trees. It's really beautiful. I mean, of course, Salt Spring's a gorgeous place.
It's sort of Mediterranean climate out there, isn't it?
It is. I think it's zone 9. So.
Right.
I have outside here, I have the plants probably that are pushing it the most are things like pomegranates. I have a type of banana that a lot of people grow here. It's a Japanese fiber banana. It doesn't actually produce an edible fruit, but I have palm, and then I have almonds and olives outside. They're fairly young. Figs are fabulous. The production is really great on them.
And then, Jane, you're making me sick. Early this morning, I was out walking around in cleats and shoving ice off the car. So, you know, spare me, please.
Well, we're having a cold spell right now. Compared to what you get.
Yeah, what's your cold spell like?
Well, I'm getting -7 nights, so that's cold for here. So it's like bundling up stuff. You know, a lot of this stuff is not really doing too well with that kind of temperature, and it's just a cold spell that's looks like it's going to be here for over 2 weeks.
So when you first moved out there, you were growing butter lettuce and basil. So tell me the system you were using to grow those products, and who were you selling to?
Actually, we were just growing lettuce only for the first probably 7 or 8 years. And we were growing with a system, a nutrient film technique system that's called NFT, hydroponic system. Well, we had been using NFT in Calgary, and we put together a very high-tech system in Calgary, but we also had the system that was designed on that Helmut Juliano, which was a very low-tech system and actually did not work efficiently. So when we came here, we were able to marry what we'd learned from both those systems and put in a really slick, inexpensive, kind of out of the hardware store kind of system using vinyl gutters. We had lids extruded, which would allow you to hook the lid up to a machine and actually turn a motor on and bring the lettuce right up to you to a harvesting height. So you weren't walking out in the crop. It's a really, really cool system that we put together. And what it meant was that we had essentially 10 crops circulating continuously, different age groups. Every week you're planting, every week you're setting out, every week you're harvesting, so that you had continuous production all year round.
Wow.
And it was a really good system with a recirculating nutrient that was being monitored by computers to maintain the proper nutrient levels and pH.
So when you were doing the lettuce, who were you selling the lettuce to?
We were selling it to wholesale grocery stores and some restaurants, but mostly wholesale to the grocery stores because you can move more efficiently.
Now, the system you mentioned that you set up sounds fairly Rube Goldbergish, very sort of techie. Is that something that you're interested in, is sort of the mechanical aspect and the system aspect of the process?
Absolutely, because of the efficiencies for your time. Like, I would like to maintain a certain wage per hour for what I'm doing, and so anything that has to do with automating or streamlining is definitely worth looking into and working on.
And why did you get into basil production?
Because I wanted to stop shipping off island. I wanted to diversify, get another crop in there so that I could develop that market and reduce my hours for deliveries off island. Because when you take the ferries, it's not only expensive, but it's hours. It's hours in lineups, etc.
It seems very much that you're focused, and even in present day, you're very focused on efficiency, of using automation as a way of increasing profit, of decreasing the amount of work that goes into the output from the greenhouse.
Yeah, looking at energy inputs. So, like, I'm talking about non-renewables or renewables, you know, just always trying to pay attention. How could they make this machine work, you know, with the limitations it has within this system?
So you're dealing with a need for production, but also in the course of doing that production, you need rainwater, you need some kind of fertilizer. So tell me a little bit, let's start with the rainwater. Like, how were you gathering water? How were you making use of water in the most efficient way possible there?
Well, to start with, we had one swimming pool. It was a 24-foot above ground secondhand pool. We probably spent $100 for, and then bought a liner and stuck it in there. And then just collecting the water off of essentially 4,000 square feet, because the greenhouse is 6,000, but it's gutter connected, so you're actually collecting off 4,000 feet of it. So that fills up a 24-foot round pool, which is in the vicinity of 14,000 gallons, pretty quickly here. So we were trucking water in, like we would bring in water once that tank emptied in the summer, because it wasn't enough to run the full production. But when I started running the greenhouse on my own, I just didn't have time for that kind of thing. So I bought three more pools, and I put in two more 24-foot diameter pools and then another 18-footer. And I was able to collect enough rainwater by the end of November. If the tanks were all empty from the summer, by the end of November, all the tanks would be full again and covered and ready for the next year. And that amount of water is enough to run the full production for 4 months with no rain. So that was what the goal was. So, and that's what I do. And I'm up to about 60,000 gallon rainwater collection now.
Sounds like you could also offer swimming lessons with all the pools
going.
Oh,
yeah, but I actually don't let anybody in the pools. They're pretty clean.
Right. Now, let's talk about fertilizing and how you make use of that. And also, I guess, too, heating for the greenhouses. So let's go through those in terms of sustainability and in terms of recyclability there. So what are you doing?
Okay, for the lettuce and the basil, I'm using pretty high-grade soluble fertilizers because I want to have the highest quality possible. You know how it is in the grocery store. People want perfect. So with the fertilizer, I have a recipe that gives me all the ideal parts per million of the macro and micronutrients. And that nutrient is recirculated continuously, so it's highly efficient on water. So what I'm selling is essentially the rainwater, you know, in the lettuce and the basil. But the nutrients are there available for the plants as they need them. And because it's recirculated, it means that my actual use of fertilizers is very, very low in comparison to, let's say, farming where you have an open system. Yes, I am using fertilizers for that aspect of production. For all the experiments and for the trees are being that I've put in the last, you know, 5 years or whatever. Those are all using the nutrients from compost on the property and from digestate from the anaerobic digester. And I do winter production of vegetables for myself with the anaerobic digester digestate, and I will pasteurize that and dilute it, adjust the pH, and then I can grow things like kales and chards and all those kinds of things really nicely with that stuff, and then also the trees benefit from the fertilizer.
Let's talk about the anaerobic digesting, and it's called digeponics, right? Because it's producing both fertilizer and methane and CO2, right?
Yeah. So I have this small system that a young engineer built that he's been experimenting with these small closed-loop systems, and it's fully automated, so it has timers, and I'm just feeding it, and then I go in and I, you know, harvest the gas and the nutrients. So all the stinky kitchen waste that I have that maybe rats might like goes into this anaerobic digester, and it processed through an anaerobic chamber, and the methane and the gases are collected and filtered for water and hydrogen sulfide, and the gas accumulates and into a pressurized system, and I use that for cooking, and I use that for CO2 enhancement. And then the digestate, what the finished product that actually goes from stinking like disgust kitchen waste that's been sitting around for a week into this slurry that smells like cow manure. So essentially, it's like a mechanical cow. So it's coming out, and as I run it quite slowly, it comes out as primarily bioavailable nutrients. So I will take some of that stuff, I filter it so that the solids come out, and that makes a really nice soil amendment, very stable, full of nutrients. And the fluid I will pasteurize with the methane and dilute it, and I can use that as a hydroponic solution for growing vegetables and whatever I choose to grow.
So Jane, let's just to recap, you talked about using water that you harvest off the roof for watering the plants, the butter, lettuce, the basil, and now your subtropical fruits and vegetables that you're growing. And then also an anaerobic digestion process, a digeponic system, and that's providing methane that you can use to cook with and also to add the CO2 back into the greenhouse to sort of augment that. So what are you using in terms of heating for the greenhouse?
I'm using a wood gasifier furnace. In the old days, I had a oil furnace. It was becoming crazy expensive, but I just didn't feel good about it either. But I kept that oil furnace and took the oil burner out of it and put a radiator on the top of it so that I'm using all the controls. But I'm now using the wood gasifier's heat for a hydronic system in the greenhouse. So I'm using hot water to heat. And I have a large storage area, about 4,500 gallon tank in the greenhouse that's fully insulated that stores heat to augment the furnace's output during really cold periods of time. So like right now, it's -7 at night, and I've heated that 4,500 gallons to about 35, 38 degrees centigrade. So that when the furnace is running, it doesn't have to heat as much. It's being augmented by the heat in that tank.
So how much electricity are you using? Because it sounds like you're being very efficient in terms of heating with the wood system and with the methane for cooking. You're generating heat in your own kitchen there. So what kind of electricity bill are you running?
I have a lot of other stuff going on this property, but because I have a walk-in cooler and I have various other things. I do have solar that manages the digester, and I'm actually in the process of designing a larger system so that I'll be less reliant, especially if we have a crazy weather event like we had in December. My bills are, I don't know, probably I'm paying under $200 a month for the full farm with two domiciles and a full workshop.
Wow, pretty amazing. So why does that matter to you? Why does it matter to live sustainably the way you're doing?
Why does it matter? It's always mattered to me because I'm concerned about my footprint. You know, I like to balance my passions with some sort of sustainable model here because I see what's going on with this planet, and I'm looking at resilience. I'm looking at like a model of how to live and be productive without using too much. I don't know. It's just something I've always been thinking about.
Clearly, you've been thinking about it because you've been doing a lot of designing. And so tell me about that. Tell me where, is that something that you taught yourself, or do you have a background in mechanical engineering, or how does that expertise come about?
I'm so happy about Google. you know. I can, you know, if I want to find out, okay, what's the sustainable yield of my 2-acre forest? You know, like I want to balance the sustainable yield of my forest with the size of the wood furnace that I'm going to buy. So I can see, okay, if I was to harvest sustainable yield, could I run my greenhouse with that? That I can go onto Google and I, you know, just have to have an idea and then figure out the right words to find it. I can find a formula for figuring that out. And then I can design my system along those lines. Like that's the kind of thing I think about. I just love that I can just come up with an idea and then just search and search and then just see, oh, there is a precedent here. I don't have a background in mechanical engineering, but I do have a buddy that is a mechanical wizard, my neighbor Barry, who's helped me. If I talk ideas to him, he understands things. He's been a huge educator for me.
Jane, and I don't mean to be ageist, but you're old enough that you could be retired. I'm old enough that I could be retired. But I don't get a sense that you're planning on retiring anytime soon, right?
No. In a way, I feel like I have retired as of a week ago because I decided I'm not going to grow basil anymore. So, you know, no lettuce, no basil, that's like a lot of years of doing that. And that, you know, when you're growing crops, it's constant. You just have to be available all the time to make sure everything's okay. All machines are, you know, running and your market is, you know, everybody's okay with what's going on and you're meeting their needs. That's huge to let go of that. So, and citrus trees or trees, period, they don't have that kind of demanding production sort of interaction. It feels a bit like puttering, what I'm doing now. And so I think that's a perfect definition of retirement.
Well, especially puttering with subtropical fruit. let's talk a bit about the fruit that you're growing there, because it's pretty amazing. So give us a rundown on the sort of variety that you've got going.
Well, right now, this is, what is this, February 7 or 8 or something. I've got ripe right now. I have kumquat, 2 varieties of grapefruit, probably about 7 varieties of mandarin, 4 varieties of navel oranges, 2 varieties of lime, 3 varieties of lemon. And then I can, when I break off a branch of yerba mate by mistake, I can try that and drink it. So there's lots of fruit coming off now. And that's kind of from probably about late October till April or May is the main time for harvesting the citrus. And also I have avocados. They'll be ripe in March. And a lot of the stuff can just sit on the tree for a long time. And then in the summertime, I have those purple passion fruit and jujubes and, you know, lemongrass and turmeric and ginger. And, you know, it's just pretty cool.
It's pretty cool is an understatement. So what are you doing with that produce? Are you selling it to local restaurants? Or
I'm selling some of it to a restaurant in Vancouver. I sell it to people when they turn up. I sometimes have a little sale where I'll just, you know, have baskets of fruit. And I'm making a lot of marmalade. We make limoncello and really experimenting with the citrus. I eat a lot of citrus. Plus, because it's all organically grown, I dry all the peel, and I, you know, have dried peel and candied peel. And it's still kind of experimenting. This is the first year where I've had too much citrus. Like before that, I might sell like, I don't know, $500 worth. But this year, it's starting to require that I be a little bit more businesslike with the production. And that's part of why I'm going to stop growing basil and lettuce, because I can see that I should put a little bit more energy into marketing.
It really strikes me that at this point in your career, you're no longer selling the butter lettuce and the basil, and you're focusing in on the subtropicals and the fruits and vegetables that you're consuming. But what really amazes me is that you're a woman living on Salt Spring Island, and you're really sort of, I know you're getting help from Google, you mentioned, and some other folks, but you're really fundamentally going at a alone, right?
Yeah, I guess I am going at it alone, and it feels like probably one of the most special times in my life that I have the a life experience of growing different things and being exposed to different technologies and different lifestyles through my travels, that I can take what is important to me and methodically work through systems and experiment and learn from them. It's like having a full palette of colors and a great big canvas, and I'm really enjoying the process hugely.
Well, thank you very much for being such a sustainable painter with your palette, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, thanks so much for the interview.
That was Jane Squire from her little slice of diaponically enhanced heaven on Salt Spring Island in British Columbia. The other evening, I looked into the cold night air as the constellation Orion was hanging low in the sky. Its stars Betelgeuse, Rigel, and others were bright and clear. So were nearby Aldebaran, the Moon, and Mars. They were all like diamonds on velvet. Why are they so clear? To find out, I asked Robert Dick, a mechanical engineer with a love of astronomy and an advocate for eliminating light pollution that can spoil our view of the heavens. Here's our chat. Hey, Rob, thanks for joining me.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for calling.
Is it just my imagination, or it seems like in the winter, and we're recording this in February, that at night the stars are brighter, they're clearer. It just seems, it's sort of like the difference between drinking a glass of water and drinking a glass of ice water. Everything seems sort of crisper and fresher when I look up. Is that just my imagination?
Not really. There's actually two reasons for that. One is that the stars of the winter, when you look out into the winter sky, we're actually looking into the spiral arm around our galaxy in which we live. So a lot of the stars are very close to us, and as a result of that, they appear much brighter. There are also some very especially bright stars, for example, the star Sirius, which is down and to the left of where Orion is in the sky, which is high up in the center after sunset or so. And so that gives a bit of a sparkle to the sky. But also, in the summertime, you don't have those bright luminaries in the sky. They're all kind of, there's a lot of bright ones, but they're not quite that punchy. And as a result of that, they don't have that that sparkle. But also in the summertime, you have the Milky Way. We're looking through a void of space towards the center of the galaxy to the inner spiral arm. And that causes a haze across the sky that then just further reduces the sparkle of the stars.
So just so I'm clear, you're in the summertime, you're looking into the center of the galaxy, so that's creating a haze. When in the winter, we sort of swung around and we're looking at what I think is called like the Orion arm, it's sort of a spun off spiral off of the center galaxy. That's where we're looking at Orion. That's where we're seeing that sort of bright geometric shape of the bright stars in Orion, right?
That's right. It's kind of like you're already in the forest, so you don't see the forest because of the trees, and the stars would be those individual trees. So we see quite a few bright stars, and then behind or dimmer than those, we still have quite a few other fainter stars, but because we're not looking towards the most populous portion of the galaxy, there are fewer of them. The star density beyond where we are is less than it is when we look towards the center of the galaxy in the summer.
Now, that seems almost counterintuitive. You would think that if you're looking towards the center of the galaxy, there's more stars, it would be a brighter sky.
That's right. The stars in Orion are typically 1,000, 2,000 light years away, which sounds like a real great distance. But when you're looking towards the center of the galaxy, the next spiral arm is 5,000 to 10,000 light years away. And the center of the galaxy is some 25,000 light years away. So they're really dimmed by distance. There's also another reason that we don't end up seeing too many stars in the winter sky, and that is because there's a lot of dark nebula around as well that's starting to obscure some of those stars. We also have that in the summer sky, but then we have the wider expanse of the glowing Milky Way in the summer that kind of compensates for it, at least visually.
Wow, that's really interesting. Now, is there something about the atmosphere in the winter sky that makes things a little clearer as well?
Well, the cold air can't hold as much moisture as the warm air in summer, and so that reduces it. There is a downside of that, however, that I've actually experienced, because it gets so cold that the moisture in the atmosphere can freeze out as ice crystals, and that can actually reduce visibility of the fainter stars. And it's got to the point where I was out once, it was actually minus 45, real dumb, but I was young. And you could look up and you could only see the brightest stars. You couldn't see any fainter ones, yet there were no clouds. So that's another curious thing that can go on. But of course, most people don't, or actually maybe shouldn't, experience that, because it's not very healthy to go that when it's that cold.
So when it's that cold, the ice crystals are actually being held in sort of a suspension then?
That's right. They're coming down, but they're very slow. They're just settling. Again, these are very tiny crystals, but they're enough to scatter the light.
Now, I want to come back to Orion and also in terms of scattering of light, because as we're recording this, there's a study going on in, or a survey being going on, a sort of citizen science project in Britain, where people are being asked to look at the constellation Orion, which we just talked about, and count the number of stars they can see with the naked eye. And the intention of that, I think, is to get a sense of the effect of light pollution on their viewing opportunity. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There are many, many more fainter stars than brighter stars. So if you look at a particular area of sky and you count the number of stars, the larger the number of stars, then the fainter you're able to see. And light pollution forms a luminous veil in front of the stars. So the fainter stars are just overwhelmed by this veil of light and you can't see them. So, for example, in a city, you might see perhaps 10 stars in the constellation, in the center of the constellation of Orion, whereas if you go out under a dark sky, you might see 50 to 100. By counting the number of stars in these areas, it's a bit of a metric or a proxy for how dark your sky is.
So it's interesting. We started our conversation about the ability to see brighter stars in the sky looking brighter in the winter because we're turned away from the center of the galaxy. So that is creating sort of a deep sky light pollution, looking into all of those dimmer stars, but so many of them. But now we're talking about a light pollution that's very close up, so like sort of on the other side of the stars, right?
That's right, in our atmosphere. And there's nothing we can do about the deep space illumination, but there's a great deal we can do with the nearer, the earthbound illumination. Don't use as bright a light. Make sure it shines down, not up, because if it shines up, it's scattering off the dust and aerosols or large molecules in the atmosphere and just scattering back down to us and producing that luminous veil in front of the stars. The other way of doing it is just to reconsider what you're using the light for. For example, it's quite common, especially in cities and even in the country, where people turn on their lights and they go to bed. And this is supposed to give them security, but all they do is illuminate their property and all their things outside their house for the ne'er-do-wells to come by and pick and choose. They don't even need a flashlight. So it's better actually to keep the lights off. And if you do expect visitors, then you can leave a light on so they can find your place. But if you're not expecting visitors or perhaps don't want visitors, then you should turn them off.
Well, Rob, thanks very much for ironically sort of throwing a light on the night sky and why it is brighter and what we can do to make it even brighter for other people who want to observe it. So thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks very much, Wayne.
That was Robert Dick from The Deep Dark Night. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harrismith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple iTunes or in your favorite podcast player. And please tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you'll find more great stories, recipes, and ideas. Until next time, for Harrismith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in soon for the next episode of Harrismith Radio.